Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to look forward to growing old? How can our lives grow richer and more satisfying even as our bodies lose the vitality of youth? My guest today has given a lot of thought to aging in recent years, both on behalf of his older marriage and family counseling clients and as a person who has begun his own journey into the second half of life. And while he is no stranger to the decline in physical health that can affect us as we age, he also believes older age can be a time of unparalleled self-esteem, positive influence on others, and inner tranquility. Michael Gurian is co-founder of the Gurian Institute and author of the new book, The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Thank you. It's so great to be here. Thank you, Chris.
How is, as everything else, how is the baby boomer generation redefining American expectations of growing old?
Well, yeah, we kind of have, I'm 55, mm-hmm. Born in 58. I think we've looked at everything, gender roles, social roles. So it's logical that we're going to look at aging. And, of course, our population, we're a large group, so we're sort of forcing it. So I think this is very much a baby boomer thing that, of course, will fan out to everyone coming forward from now. And the primary reason is we're living so long. So it's the baby boomers who are living this long in such large groups. And so with all our other social roles thinking, we're thinking this out.
You know, it's interesting, though, because, of course, the baby boomers and their vast size has given them a lot of demographic power, power to sort of do things the way they wanted things done. I mean, nobody really has control over the aging process. And nobody, no matter how much you vote and how much your friends agree, everybody gets older.
Everybody gets older, yeah. And we should admit up front, you know, the title of the book is The Wonder of Aging, right? So mm-hmm. It is quite a positive book. It's about positive aging. But I'm admitting up front, as we all are, that it's tough, that aging is tough. And some of this toughness of it that we need to think out and look at, and that is inevitable, because as you say, everyone's going to go through it. Who lives that long is going to go through it. Some of it is kind of miraculous, too, because we're 110 years ago, the average life expectancy was 49. Mm. So turn of the last century, 1900, 49. So now, you know, it's in late 70s, early 80s, depending on where you are. So we've almost gained another lifetime, and many folks will go through it. Millions and millions and millions will live. We've got 11,000 people turning 60 every day. So it's kind of miraculous in comparison to 110 years ago, and I am treating it as a miracle, admitting also, though, that it is tough and that it should be the toughness of it that inspires us to do this deep thinking about it.
You identify three distinct stages of life after 50, each of which has a different goal. Why is it important not to sort of lump later life into one big stage and assume it's all the same?
Well, that's it. That's what it's all about. We've kind of treat aging as, and this was some of the core of this book, why I wanted to do this book. We treat it as a big lump, like we're aging, or we get old, or we become old, or we're elderly, right. Or we become a senior, mm-hmm. right? So it's all kind of a one word. And so part of my inspiration was my mom was a gerontologist. And one of her good friends was Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and they worked together starting hospices. And so my adolescence was spent with her and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, you know, arguing over the dinner table. Hmm. And she, of course, would be the first person to introduce me to the staging concept. So when I was a kid. So then, you know, a lot of things change in life, et cetera. But all through my life, I've been concerned with trying to stage things and figure out what are the stages of boyhood, of girlhood, of adulthood, of middle age. And so it was really logical for me as a developmentalist to look at what are the stages of this. So I put the science-based research together with blue zones around the world and together with biochemistry and together with sociological evidence. And what I found was 50 to 65-ish, right? I mean, being somewhat loose, 65 to 80, and then 80 to completion. And those, I found are distinct biological stages for us in terms of our developmental growth, and also psychological, relational, and spiritual stages, I'm arguing.
So 50 to 65 is what you call, and I love this, the age of transformation, which for many of us means years when we're still working, often still caring for children and aging parents together. So still plenty of stress during this time for many people.
A lot, yeah. And it is transformation. As we did, I and the Gurian Institute team, we sent out just under 5,000, a survey of just under 5,000 to try to get people to weigh in, also to help us understand what they were living. And a number of things came up for this 50 to 65 age group, and primarily was transformation, that everyone does go through not just the biological transformation of menopause and andropause, which is the baseline, but also then transformation in a job, transformation in a relationship. These could be ors. Transformation regarding parents. One or both parents might die during that period as one is giving care. And even a spouse may die. Transformation could be a divorce. Transformation, it always revolves around something having to do with one's close identity. And really, basically to a person, everyone said they were going through something in the 50 to 65 age group. So that's a transformation that includes our closest relationships. And how we maximize it is to look carefully at stress, because our bodies are going through the transformation. So as maybe we'll get to further in the program, that if we don't de-stress between 50 and 65, we could be in trouble.
I was really interested that in this book you give nearly equal weight to andropause as you give to menopause, whereas, andropause doesn't usually get as much recognition in our culture. Can you talk about how it works and how the hormonal changes in men compare with women as they pass out of their childbearing years?
Yeah, female is more complex, so it gets more play and it's more obvious because menses ends and et cetera. So it is logical that female is always going to be more something we concentrate on more. But I think we do that to our peril to some extent, because men are going through these changes and a lot of relationships are ending that maybe could stay together. I mean, really, a lot of people then look back 5 years after they end that relationship when they're both 55 and say, oh, shoot, And part of what they're not realizing, and part of just generally what people are not realizing, like in the workplace, is men starting around 45, primarily it has to do with the testosterone decreasing, has profound effects on our moods. So, for instance, just one example is we can have these quick bursts of irritability, and people won't understand why. They'll think it's personal. This often happens in my marriage and family practice. People will think it's personal now. Like, why was he not this way when we were 30? Why is he angry at me so much? And some of it is that as the testosterone decreases, the system's trying to reorient, and it takes about 10 years at least for it to reorient. And for males, because of the way our systems are set up, we will tend toward quick bursts anyway, quick bursts of energy. And so when we get angry, we tend toward these quick bursts of anger. Another thing is that we can get depressed as the testosterone goes down, but the depression is masked because we seem angry, and people don't realize, oh, well, he's actually depressed. So it's very deep, actually.
When you point this out, in particular to a male client who's been dealing with this in a relationship, I mean, are they surprised? Are they relieved to find that maybe there's some biological explanation for moods that they couldn't otherwise explain?
Yeah, I'm science-based, and so I'm in my 25th year now of teaching this, and I've found that the science base is really, really valuable for communicating with everybody, and that many men especially need the science base to believe. Because if we just go at this from our sort of psychosocial point of view, a lot of men see our profession and just see our advice giving as being kind of soft. And they kind of, they walk away pretty quickly from therapy or from this kind of help that we want to give them. But if we can base it in science and show them, like in my speeches, I show PET scans and SPECT scans of the brain. I mean, if we can do that stuff with men, I think it helps both genders, but I think especially for men, they need that to believe in it. And once they see it, they'll go, oh, wow. And then spouses, I mean, it's amazing how many women don't know about andropause or don't realize that it's a profound part of their husband's transformation. So it really can bring relief to them as well.
What is intimate separateness, and why can it be such a good thing for couples who have been together often for decades?
Yeah, the chapter on intimate separateness, of course, is not surprisingly also we look at sex in that chapter too, because sexuality is transforming and relationships are transforming. And so intimate separateness is a term that I developed in the early 90s. And I've been gradually teaching it and helping people with it. It comes from attachment theory. The term is mine, but the idea comes from attachment theory. And in attachment, oneness is a huge part of attachment. It's the obvious part of attachment, right? You have a baby and you are really one with your baby. You get together with a lover, a partner, who becomes your life mate, let's say, and it starts out as oneness. You're really inside each other's heads. You feel so one. Your biochemistry is so one. So that's attachment. Now, as attachment grows, what we talk about less but is equally important is how we do the separateness, because attachment can't just be the oneness. We all are living lives, and if we give up our identity or give up our independence or our separateness, that first 2 years of biochemistry that creates the oneness, that'll dissipate, and then we're into a whole different ball game. And if we want that ball game to last, we're going to have to also master separateness. So that's why that chapter is helping people with that and helping them understand the sort of fears that come around with being fully and happily separate. And I am making the argument that you can't, at a certain point, relationships will not stay together. My research is showing they will not stay together anymore, since religion doesn't hold most of them together and social roles don't hold most of them together. They don't tend to stay together anymore beyond the child-raising years unless we've balanced intimacy and separateness.
And so the mistake, I guess, that people make is they compare, you know, you're 60 years old, you've been married for 35 years, and you compare the way you feel about your spouse with the way you felt at 26 or 28.
Well, yeah, that's part of the transformation and part of the de-stressing. One of the best things we can do to de-stress, this book is sort of a handbook on how to de-stress your life so that you can live, you know, pretty happily and successfully. And one of the things we've got to do is we've got to become realistic about this relationship. And of course, the term, you know, I use is realistic optimism. So I'm not saying realistic in a pessimistic way, but we're realistic. We understand this relationship, this person's not going to change. I'm not going to change. So how are we going to develop the life rhythms and the rituals that allow for both intimacy and separateness? And when we think back to where it was long ago, then we think mainly back to intimacy. Like I tell the story of some clients who in this case, she had come to me first and he had been changing. He was being less intimate. And they had been together 23 years at that point. He was being less intimate. And her standard was what it was like back before andropause and back before menopause and back before the transformation. So I was helping them to understand, okay, you're in a transformation now. You're in the age of transformation. It is a different stage.
One of the amazing things about the age of transformation is that this can be a time when we start to let go of the fears and of the resentments that plagued us in our younger adulthood.
Yeah, it's so important. It's part of the de-stressing. We have to always remember that our cells in the brain and cells in the body, can't handle the stress they used to have. So we're going to have to, you know, we're going to have, let's say, 10 or 20 stressors in our lives, and some of them are duty. We have to have them, like caring for our parents, caring for our kids. And, of course, they bring us a lot of depth and meaning. So if we're going to have those stressors. But there are some other stressors that we really need to let go of. And in our relationships, there are some relationships that are causing us incredible stress because of the way we approach them, the fears that we have, the fears we're feeding into or enabling. And it's so wonderful for people to work through these. And they may need, you know, professional help or mentorial help in their family. They may need to journal. I mean, there's a number of tools to help them. They need to know it'll take a while. You know, it's not going to happen in a day because of the entrenchment of these systems. But when the transformation does occur and the de-stressing does occur, we want to remember that the reward is not just that we'll live longer, but that we're going to have less mental illness going into stages 2 and 3. We're going to have less internal pressure that causes, and so we'll have less depression, less anger, and less problems.
Michael Gurian is my guest. His new book is called The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Join the conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Michael Gurian. He is a marriage and family counselor and co-founder of the Gurian Institute. His newest book is called The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Michael, assuming that during the age of transformation, we want to, as you say, de-stress, we want to take stock of where we are in life and what we've done so far and clarify our priorities, it seems that letting go of our anxieties is maybe easier said than done. Do you have advice on that?
Yeah, absolutely. It is easier said than done, and it generally will need some form of mentorial help. So could be a counselor or some other form of getting some assistance. Could be some peers that one turns to help one. So the first thing is to reach out and find sort of what person is going to help us. And then we identify the two or three, you know, that are primary, because having a certain amount of anxiety is just part of life, and that's fine, really. It's inspiring to have some anxiety. But the two or three things that are debilitating us, so fear of inadequacy. So then what I'm saying in here in the book is if you ask someone from the outside to pick for you, we should all pick ourselves, but some help would be to look at fear of inadequacy and where that comes from. Because, you know, when we only lived to 49, we didn't really have to deal with, we didn't have another 30 or 40 years to have an identity and a self and to become an elder. And so we didn't often have to step back and confront the fear of inadequacy that we carry into the years of 50 to 60 to 70 to 80. Now is the time to really look at that fear of inadequacy, where it comes from, how we're taking it forward, how it's making us angry, anxious, how it may be distorting or harming our relationships. So if I had to pick one, I would pick that to focus on, and then a whole beautiful web of other things will emerge.
How often do you find that this sense of inadequacy is something that is held only by the individual, that, say, family members or friends or colleagues don't necessarily see that person as inadequate at all?
Often happens. Mm-hmm. It's built into the human psyche to be relatively humble. You know, I mean, there are some folks who we'd say are narcissistic, and so therefore that's a different dialogue. But it's built into us to have what Artie Lang called ontological insecurity, which is we know we're really small in the big universe. And as we're raising kids, we get married, let's say, if we go that route, and we're raising kids, let's say, you know, we're so busy and we're working and we're just so busy that we just push through. You know, when we may suffer some things along the way, we may become addicted and it may stop us, but if not, we may push through. And then we get into this wonder of aging time when the kids maybe are grown and our relationship is sort of stabilized, or we're in a new relationship and our workplace, we know that we're pretty good at what we do. This is a time when maybe it emerges and we haven't noticed it, and certainly other people may not have noticed it if we were successful before, because we were just so busy and just pushing through it all.
Let's talk about the age of distinction, mid-60s to late 70s. We are officially senior citizens at this point, and you write that although ambition is no longer a dominant force in our lives, we have in some ways become our own experts. What does that mean?
Well, yeah, we have a sense now of what we know. To some extent, we'll understand that we don't know very much at all, you know, and that's sort of an ontological spiritual principle. At the same time, we have a sense of what our expertise was and is. It's the very expertise that in our 70s we'll tend to notice is dissipating some. Now, of course, there will always be exceptions. We always want to say there are some people like, you know, perhaps Hillary Clinton will run for office. Well, if so, she's going to be, you know, she's doing something else than most of us do.
Right.
Most of us don't run for president. But the principle will still apply that she is clearly her own expert. So for most of us, though, we're going to slow down some. And while some of us are still working at 65, 70, 75, most of us are also slowing down. And the slowing down is really healthy, And for those of us who like volunteer now, we're taking it into service. We're taking it into purpose. And the word, the key word is distinction. We have a clear sense of who we are, and it's really important to us to pass that on. So for a lot of people, so I have the chapter on the grandparent brain, because for a lot of people, the distinction and the passing on does happen with grandkids. And or it can happen in other ways, passing on our company, passing on our knowledge and our wisdom. And I'm begging everyone throughout life to be mentors to others, but especially in this age of distinction, to make sure to be mentoring one younger person as the elder who's mentoring that one younger person. Because one of the things we lose, especially in the U.S., I did a lot of cross-cultural research, and this is a big thing in the U.S., since we're not recycling the wisdom of elders and the distinction and legacy and identity of elders, the younger people are losing that wisdom. They're not coming up with that wisdom, and our culture needs it. You know, I mean, our culture is in some distress, and we really need the distinction and legacy of these folks who are 60, 65, 70, 75.
What is it about American culture that is so youth-centered and sort of dismissive of the value of having many years under your belt?
There's a number of things, of course. One is we have a much deeper fear of death than I can really find almost anywhere else. I've got some analysis on that, and we can talk about that. I don't know if I'm right. I don't know that anyone really understands why we are so afraid of death in this country. So maybe that's a different topic, but I think that's part of it, and it's part of what drives us toward youth. But some of the other stuff that drives us toward youth is that youth is really fun. We feel very free when we're younger. We feel limitless when we're younger. You know, there's a lot to love about youth, and so we think back toward it, and we try to sustain it as long as possible. The positive of that is that it's neat. It's part of our journey, especially in the age of transformation, especially 50 to 65. It's neat to try all these things like testosterone patches and, you know, with doctor's approval, obviously, Viagra, all these things, because they do elicit other parts of the self that, you know, 100 years ago, 55-year-olds couldn't access. So there is something really interesting about this from an experimental point of view. But by the time we get to 65-ish, I can basically promise people if they're still living that, then they are going to be hit. They're going to hit a wall, because by 65, it's really tough to be looking back toward youth. And I think they're just putting off understanding the wonder of aging.
So this is interesting. You know, people who get into their late 60s, into their 70s, they're at a point when they recognize that time is precious, that life is precious, and really don't want to waste either one on petty conflicts.
Right. Yeah, we're ready to sort of pass on our identity and become an elder. And you're absolutely right. I tell a story in the book of a woman named Trudy whose whole family didn't, they were in significant conflict. She was in her 70s. They were in significant conflict, and it's like she didn't get this, what you're saying. She would say, I should be treated as an elder no matter what, because I'm 75. So I should be treated as an elder. But she pushed away. She was pushing away basically everyone in her family. She was so critical and judgmental and so on. And the work with her in that case was to help her to understand that it really, for her as an elder, it's too petty. I mean, she's not actually fully being able to advance to become an elder, and her family is not going to treat her like an elder if she's constantly criticizing and judging them. And she needed to click on the fact that it becomes petty to keep doing that same stuff, and that you basically push people away. So I think that it's going to happen for everyone, hopefully at some point, where they look at their relationships and they say, okay, let's see. You know, I'm a pretty good person, but look at these three or four relationships. What's the pattern here? What's happening? Is it petty? And if so, I'll just get the help I need to get to move through that, because we've got 10 or 20 more years and we want joy. You know, the whole point of the wonder of aging is freedom and joy. And we need to live toward that, especially as our bodies decay, and kind of kill some of the joy, you know.
You've observed that this is a time in life when many people become more interested than ever in spirituality. And is that more than simply a factor of realizing we're about to meet our maker? I mean, is there more to it than that?
Well, I think you're right. The bottom line is we start dealing with mortality in middle age. We start seeing it coming. And then definitely by the time we get into the first stage of aging, the age of transformation, we definitely see it coming. Everyone is going through something that is physically connecting them to some amount of something going on, whether it's their friend dying of cancer or their spouse or they get cancer or they need back surgery or they can't play soccer anymore or whatever it is. And so that the physical starts defining the mind and the mind realizes, you know, death's coming. Then we are burying more and more people. You know, we're going to more and more funerals. And so then as we're getting older and older, more and more, and we definitely see that death is coming for us and mortality is the baseline. And so it inspires, hopefully, obviously my hope in providing this resource is to help people to focus on what I call the seven concentrations, these concentrations that if you focus on them, they take that reality and they move it to a more psycho-relational and spiritual realm. So for instance, you see the second and third and fourth chances. So you say, okay, yeah, I'm going to die, but I can take a second chance, I can take a third chance, I can take a fourth chance, I've got 30 or 40 years. I could do this other career. I can go volunteer in China. I can do this and that. And it becomes part of a new spiritual quest, and it's not the heroic quest where you ended up, you know, at the end of the fairy tale. This is a whole new spiritual quest, and we have 30 or 40 years to live it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Beth who says, I'm a marriage and family therapy student at Texas Women's University, and I find the intimacy and separateness theory very interesting. My question is about utilizing your ideas for various age ranges and non-heteronormative intimate relationships. And by heteronormative, I'm assuming non-heteronormative, I'm assuming Beth is talking about same-sex relationships.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it applies. I've written two previous books that use this. One is Love's Journey, where I introduced it. That's about 20 years ago. Then another one about 10 years ago, What Could He Be Thinking? And then this book. So those might help as resources. Definitely intimate separateness applies to all stages of relationship, and Love's Journey identifies 12 stages of relationship. So that's starting from the day you meet and going all the way until your death or your spouse's death. So it does apply across the board. And the second thing is it does apply. All attachment theory applies to all attachments, and it absolutely applies to gay and lesbian transgender relationships, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What is the value of keeping a journal or even writing a memoir if people are interested in that?
Well, one of the ways to pass on, to pass one's identity on and to fulfill that sort of sacred duty in life is to keep a journal and pass the parts of that on that aren't too private, and also to write a memoir. And so I do have sections in there where I'm asking people and kind of coaching people on how to keep a journal that becomes a spiritual journal for this new quest, and also to write memoirs if they can. And they don't have to be fancy. They can even be done with pictures and so on. And I can basically coach people to do that so they can pass this on. And each chapter of the book starts out with a piece of my journal. I write every morning. I have a spiritual practice every morning. So I put at the beginning of each one my best stuff. We should tell readers, I'm not putting my bad stuff. The best stuff. So, you know, they're just a page long, but I'm hoping to inspire people to do that for themselves, to be expressing their spiritual vision, you know, that will be hopefully passed on to their families and into the world. So both journaling and memoir writing, I think, are of great value. And I think part of it is because words are of deep human value. And even though we have Facebook, and that's really great, we don't want to downplay how important words are to the development of the brain and to the extension, the plasticity and extension of a powerful brain all the way through life. So in this, you know, 50 to 90 or however long we're going to live, the more words we can use in more meaningful ways, it's actually even better for our brain than just doing Facebook.
Do you find that there are some clients who go into this exercise of journaling sort of reluctantly, only to be really surprised at how much they gain from it?
Yes, and it's male and female do that. I mean, generally women are more, they grab it quicker. Mm-hmm. You know, they are more word-oriented on average anyway. So they grab it quicker, and they have less surprise, I found, in really enjoying it. And it doesn't mean they're going to do it for 40 years, but they do it for as long as it gives them joy, stop doing it, and then 5 years later take it up again. Mm-hmm. With men, I think there's more surprise with men, because men don't tend to turn toward words like that. I mean, there's some very verbal men like myself, but and some listeners, but, you know, a lot of men are not really turning to it first response. I'm going to go write some words down. But then they get into it, and what they get into is not just the words, but the ritual. They really get into the ritual, and especially I'm coaching them to do it so that they're talking to someone. You know, they're talking to their grandson, or they're talking to their spouse or granddaughter, you know. So, like, there's audience reception involved, and that seems to help and helps them use it for a longer period of time.
We have an email here from Tom in Fort Worth who says, can you comment on the abyss phenomenon, which is the idea that out there in the future, the individual sees a complete lack of meaningfulness in the life they can see. Is this part of andropause?
I would argue it's part of both andropause and menopause, and there are some ways in which males would get hit with it more than females, and so I think that there's some wisdom in what this person is saying, and in terms of identifying it more with andropause, although everyone can experience it, but males are going to have defined their lives often along more narrow lines than females have. So they're living the first 50 years sort of, many of them, like juggernauts, you know, just locomotives, just going forward and setting goals and reaching goals. And then in the age of transformation, generally some trauma happens. Maybe he or she loses a job, loses a relationship. Something happens that's pretty big, and often that will trigger a sense of abyss going forward, because I've identified myself with that and it's gone. And then andropause is only sort of making that worse, and especially if he or his counselors or his spouse or people don't know about andropause, it can make it worse, because another way he defined himself was testosterone. That's naturally how we define ourselves, and that's part of the juggernaut. But now that internal fail-safe for forward-looking and for goal-setting is diminishing, right? Testosterone is an internal fail-safe that pushes us, motivates us forward, but it's dissipating. And in some men, it can go down 50%, almost, it seems like, suddenly. So, yes, that abyss factor is important, and we really want to get help for that guy as soon as possible.
Michael Gurian is my guest. He's a marriage and family counselor and co-founder of the Gurian Institute. His newest book is called The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. We will continue the conversation in a few minutes. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration opens on August 6th. Catalogs can be requested at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is family and marriage counselor and co-founder of the Gurian Institute, Michael Gurian. His new book is called The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Michael, we come to a point in our lives where perhaps we're no longer working or no longer working full time. We have a chance to reflect. For some people, there will be real and serious regrets. And some of those things might be, you know, we might be able to make up for lost time or make amends. In some cases, there will be things we regret that we can't do anything about. What do you suggest we do in order to cope with those and fully embrace and enjoy what remains of our lives?
It's so important to work it through, and then when we get to the point, which I'm thinking 100% of us will get to, that there's going to be something we regret or some things we regret that we can't, quote-unquote, fix. And when we get there, there's a principle that I talk about in the book, which I really gained from living in India, and the principle of renunciation, where we just have to let it all go. And the metaphor that I use in there is the metaphor of the sannyasi, you know, the person who knows that he or she is in a new stage of life, and whatever happened in the previous stage happened, and now I'm in a new stage. And this new stage, I give up, so I mean this kind of metaphorically because we won't do this literally, I give up everything. I let go of everything, and it's a complete detachment that I'm looking for. And I just walk out with my begging bowl and my staff, and I travel through India. Okay, so I mean that metaphorically because we're not going to do that at 80 years old. But the metaphor is good. There are things we just have to let go of. And I'm hoping that that metaphor helps people because at a certain point, the journey becomes about detaching. And if we can detach, you know, it's the next stage of being an elder. And if we can detach, we will find that we are happier. We also will all know people who can't detach, and they're very angry. They're 80 or 85, and they're very angry. And so I say in there, there's no right way to die, no right way to get old, but there is a better way. And the renouncing the regrets, the detachment with a capital D, I think is the better way.
So tell us more about what you call the age of completion, which is your third of three stages here. What ideally, what happens during that time?
Well, let's say that I'm laying these out as if, let's say, that we are, that the person is living to 80. So if someone is living 75 to 80, I'm saying it appears we are entering a new biological stage as well as social, emotional, and spiritual stage. That stage is completion because now we're, you know, as we get in our 80s, we're certainly still vital. So this is not about that. We're all still vital. But we also are feeling that, wow, you know, I've now been to 30 funerals in the last 5 years or whatever it is. And I need to complete myself because it's getting really imminent. And so what does completion mean? It's going to mean completing these relationships, healing regrets if possible, making sure I passed on my legacy, completing my memoir if that's what I'm doing, anything around that, making sure all the pictures are together. Like my dad's 84, and one of the things he's doing right now is he's taking, my mom passed away about a year and a half ago, and my dad is taking all of their slides from our lives. We lived all over the world, all of that, and he's putting everything onto these DVDs. And he wants to complete that. I want to finish this. I need to complete that. So it's a really neat urge, even though he may live for many, many more years, but it's that urge. And there's the completion with our spouse. And so with our spouse and with ourselves, the completion is going to move toward death itself. Because either in that age group, we're going to help our spouse complete his or her life if we are married. And we may have already done that if we're a widow or a widower. And or we're going to then complete our lives into death. So that's why the last chapter then is about that. And one of the key principles of that I'm asking people to look at is that if we see this age of completion as its own stage and we honor it, then we're going to have to honor people having freedom to complete themselves the way they want. So we're going to need to move as a society, especially as we get more and more people living in that age group and dying in that age group, we're going to have to move in a society toward the concept of a service death. I call it a service death or a free death, in which people get to say, okay, I no longer want to, you know, I know you can keep me alive for another 3 months, but that's going to cost $200,000. The service I'd like to provide is my legacy. I want to stop now. I don't want to spend that $200,000 or $300,000. So, or whatever it is that we want to hang on to pass on as our legacy, we have to have the right to complete ourselves when we want to complete ourselves. And that would include, even if we're not terminal by definition of a law, it would include our ability to say, I'm done. So it's a little controversial in that chapter.
Yeah, I was really interested to read that you had all of that in there because it is something that, not that you necessarily would shy away from controversy, but it is something we sort of haven't agreed on yet as a society. Perhaps we will, perhaps we'll never quite come to a place where most people feel that this is appropriate. But you had some sort of physical pain in your own life that made you at least contemplate how this might feel when you get to a very advanced age.
Yeah, well, so for me, I mean, when I was 49, becoming 50, I discovered I had really bad problems with my discs and my neck, and I was having chronic pain and muscle atrophy, and finally I had to have surgery, and there's a whole other backstory I won't share, but I mean, it just took ages. Finally, I had surgery. Well, I didn't fully recover. I'm in that 15% that keeps having muscle atrophy, and so I have chronic pain, and so I've had to adapt to it, and of course, I had suicidal ideation. I was in terrible pain. I'm ready to end it.
Yeah.
I mean, I've gone through all of that, which in some way I believe everyone will go through in their lives, if they have not already, where they will say, I should have the right to die. So I'm looking at people, and then of course I'm giving care to, as everyone really is these days, giving care to people who are older. And I got to engaging in dialogue with my mother, who was a gerontologist, and my father, and then Dr. Lloyd Halpern, an anesthesiologist who's in the book, and others, asking them about it. And, you know, there's a lot of us out there who are saying this, and who are saying that we are going to confront it. The society will awaken to this because the sheer numbers will force it. Force the society to awaken. And one of the reasons that the society says, oh, no, we shouldn't let people end their lives when they want, is that it'll teach young people to do it, right? I mean, that's the sort of the line that we hear. But there is no proof of that, that if an 82-year-old says, oh, well, look at me, I'm in chronic pain and I'm ready to move, I'm ready to see the next dimension, there's no evidence showing that that's going to then talk a 15-year-old into killing himself or herself. So our whole logic base really isn't right. And I think now as we get 5, then 10, then 20, then 30 million people, you know, just in America, entering the age of completion, that this is going to become a bigger dialogue.
Is there any reason to worry, Michael, setting aside what sounds to me like a straw argument as well, that, you know, that would, you know, encourage suicide among much younger people. Is there any reason to worry that if we decide that people of a certain age with particular health problems have the right to end their own lives, that on the other side of things, there are people who say, well, look, this person at 82 with serious chronic health problems chose to end his or her life. Why should we as a society continue to pay for the care of someone who does want to live?
Well, you're absolutely right. That's part of this dialogue that has to happen. That'll probably happen with the healthcare dialogue, which is going to go on for decades, because that will have to shift. And as that shifts, I think this will be part of that. I can't foresee a society in which anyone's going to say, "Well, we're going to withhold healthcare because Mike decided to take his life, so therefore, Julia, we don't need to keep you alive." I don't think our democracy can sustain that. Hmm. I mean, I think the idea would be to increase freedom rather than decrease it. And so then the question would be, how do we pay to help Julia, who wants the help? How do we pay? But I think that's still our dialogue. Hmm. I mean, that's the dialogue we're having now. How do we pay for it? So I actually don't think that can happen. It's something to think about, but I can't conceive of a way in which increasing the freedom for Joe is going to decrease the freedom, cause effect, decrease the freedom for Julia.
Let's go to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Chris on the line in Dallas. Hello, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I missed maybe part of the phone of the program, but it sounds like the book I'll definitely be getting. And I had a question regarding what the implications are for somebody at that age. With respect to psychoactive agents, be that drugs and alcohol or just prescription drugs. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. It was kind of a poor connection, Michael. I think Chris was asking about addiction to drugs later in life.
It's becoming a huge issue. Yeah, thank you, Chris, for bringing that up. It's becoming a huge issue. There's a nursing home in which I did some research, just hands-on, to look at this. And there were people in that nursing home who were, you know, an 80-year-old, 81-year-old, 82-year-old, who had 15 meds, 19 meds that they were taking per day. And some of those are pain meds. And so there are, you know, a number of things to say. One is, if one has to have pain meds for treatment, especially in that age group, it's treatment. So we don't want to immediately think, well, it's an addiction, if the person has to have it for treatment. If, however, it's an addiction, then it is an addiction. And it's definitely happening, and I think it's actually a symptom of this larger pharmaceutical issue. And as we go deeper into this in the next 10 to 20 years, as we look at this age group more, I'm calling the age of completion. We can call it the age group from 75 to 90 or 80 to 100. As that increases, we are going to have to look at the influence of the pharmaceutical industry on that age group. And the addiction is just one piece of that influence. The 19 meds is another piece. And the cost of those 19 meds, and the fact that the people taking them don't fully understand why they're taking them. so.
I know that you're not a medical doctor, Michael, but based on your research, I think you're qualified to speak to this question. Do you think that we have enough respect in this society for the debilitating effect that pain can have on people's lives? Physical pain.
I don't know if we do. I mean, I think it's a yes and a no. I mean, those people who have been through it certainly do. But as a larger society, we are kind of fantasy oriented, and we have a fantasy that there's a certain way life will go, and that way life will go is will not really have to do with constant pain. You know, life's going to go this other way, which is going to be beautiful, and we're going to always be young, and we're going to, you know, et cetera. And it's a fantasy that drives innovation, so it's a good fantasy. But on the other hand, it's a negative because it means we just don't take on these important topics. And one of the things we have not taken on is the amount of chronic pain there is. And so I would say, you know, yes and no.
What does grandparenthood bring out in people that wasn't able to be expressed when they were simply parents?
Yes, that's part of this. There's a whole chapter just on that because there are actually some changes that happen in the brain as we become grandparents. I would argue, you know, that attachment, the attachment to the grandchild, it does so many of the things that we're talking about here, legacy, you know, the sheer love and attachment itself, the sense of freedom that I talk a lot about that people want after 50, that sense of freedom gets directed into this grandchild because, you know, as people will say, I can just, you know, when I'm tired, I just hand him back or I hand her back to the parents. I'm free to do what I want. And it is, that sense of freedom is absolutely wonderful. The joy this child brings because now we're in a different stage of life and we're not juggernauts as much as we were and locomotives as much as we were, and we do have a little more time and we will make the time. And then also some changes in the brain, like for men is the most obvious to people, how men will, the chemical stuff has to a great extent processed now, and we're through it, we're in andropause or through it and moving through it, and then we have grandkids and now we cry a little more, our eyes tear up more. There's a softening of whatever hardness we needed to succeed before that the grandchild brings out. So yes, it's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and of course, those grandparents play a huge role in, as you mentioned, the development, the sort of wholeness of a child's life coming up.
Yeah, we always want to remember that America's a bit of an anomaly, post-industrial America, in that we've isolated people, right? And I know this has been studied by everyone, so it's not new, but that we're a big country and we tend to isolate people. So, but all of our ancestors, when mom or dad wasn't available, there were, you know, grandparents, aunts, uncles available. So this is a sacred role, and it's not just a let's buy them toys role. It is the passing on of the culture, and it is the nurturing and the attachment and the teaching. All of that is happening with grandparents, and it is a really wonderful, safe way to raise kids.
Michael Gurian is a marriage and family counselor and co-founder of the Gurian Institute. His new book is called The Wonder of Aging, A New Approach to Embracing Life After 50. Michael, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Emails with comments, questions, or suggestions can go to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.